the idea is very simple, to see if also the global system can be informed by some of the values, procedures of democracy, as we know it within countries. And therefore, is democracy something which applies only within states, or can also be applied to the international sphere, starting from international organizations?
Daniel Archibugi works at the Italian National Research Council. He teaches at the University of London Birkbeck College. 30 years ago, he was among those who suggested the political project of cosmopolitan democracy. I feel very lucky to have recorded this episode with him, and you will understand why immediately. My master thesis, on which I have worked during months and months and months and months, I'm sure many students can relate to that, was entitled A Comparison Between Daniel Archibugi's and Thomas Pogge's Political Cosmopolitanism. So yeah, quite an honor for me, and I hope that you will understand with this talk why Daniel's ideas caught my attention so much.
So the idea would be to say that right now we have democracy at the national level. We don't have that at the international level, and you would like to make democracy happen at the international level.
Yes, indeed, for a variety of reasons. First of all, because democracy, even within nations, is highly an uncompleted journey. We still need to progress in order to allow citizens to participate to the political sphere, to have more rights and also more duties. But if you look at the international sphere, of course, you don't see anything like democracy. Still, the only representatives in the international scene are governments, even within international organizations. And this is also a major hampering factors of democracy within countries, because when many countries cannot decide what they're going to do because of external forces, such as interest rates, capital flows, international trade, and so on, we can say, what is a democracy inside? And therefore, the basic idea is that in order to reinforce democracy within states, we need also to expand it at the international level.
Okay, so the idea is the more we manage to have democracy at the external level, the more it will also promote democracy internally at the national level.
Hopefully, for a variety of reasons. First of all, because it means that people within states will have a say of what's happening at the international level. I mean, many issues of the contemporary society, climate change, financial flows and so on, do not respect borders. And therefore, governments pretend to be in charge, but in fact they are not. So, a national government can do a lot of good policies in order to fight climate change, but if he plans to do it alone, it's very unlikely that he will succeed, especially if it's a government of a small state. And that's the reason why more coordination is needed. That's the reason why quite a lot of things are already happening through international organizations. But within international organizations, the sole representatives are governments, not citizens. And that, I think, is an important hampering factor to introduce sound policies.
So you say that more cooperation is needed at the international level. To what extent do you go? Does it mean a world government?
A world government is a bit too much, because we have got a lot of local problems which are well organized at the local level, and the communities are different. Each of these communities has its own values. So, and even the idea of world government goes together with the idea of coercive power, and a centralized coercive power is always dangerous. And therefore, if we speak about coercive power, I think it's wiser to keep it decentralized at different levels.
Mm-hmm. So you say that it would be dangerous to have something too centralized. Do you mean because it would become authoritarian? Is that what you have in mind?
That's a risk. If you concentrate all the force within one individual place, it's a bit dangerous that it might turn into a world dictatorship. And therefore, somehow it's good that there is a decentralized power. but I repeat, in order to get something done, we need more cooperation.
Okay. So we need more cooperation, which means a bit more centralization, but not too much because it would be dangerous. So where would you situate the right equilibrium?
That's a good question. I think a very good example is the European Union. The European Union has managed to, I think, is something extraordinary, despite all the criticism that we can put, because the European Union has quite a lot of common policies. It has even a common currency. But again, this common currency, the euro, is not compulsory. Mm-hmm. And therefore, some countries which do not feel to join euro might opt out, mm-hmm. and opt out, and that I think is wise. Mm-hmm. And the European Union has not a centralized army, mm-hmm. and but still it has a lot of policies and through incentives and soft power, it manages to foster even rights and democracy within member states. We see with Hungary, if Hungary is moving towards an authoritarian situation, the European Union may say, you know, you would better stop, otherwise the other countries will not be willing to be in association with you. Mm-hmm. And the incentive to be part of the Union are so strong that I think is something which is a balance. And it worked. For example, it hasn't worked yet in Hungary, but it has worked quite well in Poland.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that would be your wish. This is the cosmopolitan democracy that you're describing, right?
That's correct.
And since when did you start to have these ideas?
Well, I mean, I started to have the ideas when, I mean, in 1990, and for a very specific historical condition. After the Cold War, the Soviet Empire collapsed, thanks to the bravery of Mikhail Gorbachev, and we had hopes that liberal democracies, which won the battle without fighting, without a war, could indeed expand the best of its values also to the East. And that somehow has succeeded, because many European countries move to be democracies, and also in other continents, for example, in Latin America. Many countries move to be democratic in Latin America, and before that they were run by dictatorships. So there was, and not only in these two continents, also in other continents, so there was very much a hope that a new wave of internal democracy might also have an impact on the international scene. Unfortunately, Western democracies were not good enough to appreciate the change and to make something important. For example, rather than also opening to Russia, they started to oppose to Russia. And that was a disaster. It was a disaster because the authoritarian forces, which in Russia has always been very strong, mm-hmm. went back to power. Mm. And took over the government, and the consequences is what we now see.
So in a way you would say, I mean, it means that us as Europeans, we have also our responsibility in what's happening now in the opposition between Russia and Western countries?
Yes, indeed. And that not only we Europeans, we Westerns, because also the United States had a crucial role in this policy. And I think, you know, the idea of Gorbachev to have one single Europe from the Urals to the Atlantic was a very fruitful idea. Mm-hmm. And of course, perhaps Russia was too large to be integrated into the European Union, but still we could have a more peaceful relationship. And therefore, you know, has not happened, and that has created something very difficult. I mean, there's no justification for the invasion of Ukraine. Mm. That's an invasion against a sovereign state, and therefore there's no justification. But again, I think this could have been prevented by opening up to a collaborative agreement with Russia, and indeed within the West, Europe had more interests to do that,
mm-hmm.
because we are close to Russia, because we have larger interactions with Russia, and therefore we should have been able to have more cooperation with Russia as well as with North America.
Okay, so for you, the root of the problem comes from lack of cooperation and openness from the start. And now that we are having this kind of opposition, I mean, how to get out of, do you still believe that cooperation is possible, or do you think now it's out of
it idea? Should be possible. Now, I think there is an important condition which needs to pay attention, and that's what in international relations is called the rally round the flag effect.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean? Whenever there is a conflict, the population within one country start to centralize around their own government.
Mm-hmm.
And when a government is in trouble, the easy way to get support internally is by waging a war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely what Putin has done.
Mm-hmm.
That not only Putin, that's precisely the reason why George W. Bush started the war in Iraq in 2003 against the mass mobilization of the public opinion. They were weak. They wanted to increase the support. How could they do that? By waging a war. And that is terrible. So that's the reason why we need more democracy across borders, because the Russian citizens should understand, and also the Ukrainian citizens should understand, that the two countries do not have to fight. It's not in the interest neither of Russia nor of Ukraine to fight. It's the interest of the authoritarian Russian government, but not of the others.
Mm.
And countries can easily integrate among themselves. Boundaries can become irrelevant, as it is the case, for example, the boundary between France and Germany. Can you imagine? Now you move from one country to another, and you don't even realize when you pass the frontier, because the two countries are strongly integrated, and therefore something similar could have been possible also among Russia and Ukraine.
So, when just one precision, when you say that they, let's say, launched an attack, because also it gathered support internally, do you think that it was done intentionally, or do you think it was just like as a result?
I think it was very much intentional.
Okay.
I think in the case of the Russian leadership, it was very much intentional.
Ah, okay.
And but again, I think that was criminal. And I am very happy that Putin has to face a criminal inquiry at the International Criminal Court.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that Putin is the sole responsible. I think that the European Union should have managed the crisis better by respecting the Minsk agreements,
mm-hmm.
by finding a solution among two countries which have a common history, a common heritage, and no reason and no interest to wage a war.
Mm.
I mean, if I can go on, you know, now I don't know what will happen. But can really Russian people think that move the frontier of 100 kilometers will increase the security of Russia?
Mm.
I mean, what's the meaning of these territorial gains in a situation in which there are strong interconnections, in which there are missiles which are much faster than any of these sort of things? And so the Russian citizens are paying a high price, because the young men are dying, often without even knowing why they're dying. They're spending a lot of resources in a country which is still has a lot of poverty for the war. They have been internationally discredited, and therefore, you know, Russia is losing the war and they are starting to lose a war from the very first day in which they started the war.
It's super serious topic, and at the same time it made me laugh when you did this like a real Italian, showing how passionate you are about the topic. I mean, I can see it's very something that is really taking you at heart, right?
Yes, of course, because we have got friends in Russia and we have got friends in Ukraine. A lot of Ukrainians are living here, and these people are suffering. For what? For what? For 100 kilometers border, border, in a situation in which many of them travel abroad and so on. It's terrible. It's terrible, and I mean, it's not only criminal. I mean, it certainly is criminal, but it's stupid. And that's the basic problem. It is a stupid war.
Yeah, because I mean, for also what I understand from what you say is that it's, I mean, of course, Ukrainians are losing with that for sure. Europeans too, United States too, maybe the world because there's a war, but also Russians are losing, and also Russia, even Putin is losing at the end. It's not even in his interest.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I wonder if Putin would still be in charge without the war. Perhaps he wouldn't.
Okay.
I don't know. But I mean, it's definitely. It's. I mean, you cannot. That's one of the problems of Russia. It is not a genuine democracy. I'm not denying that Putin, unfortunately, has a strong internal support, because he has a support, internal support, and that's the reason why he needs to keep fighting to preserve this support. While, and then I go back to my idea of cosmopolitan democracy, while if there would have been a stronger integration among the citizens of Ukraine and Russia, of Eastern Europe and Western Europe, the people could have understood. But why do we fight? I mean, there are an enormous amount of mixed families which speak Russian or Ukrainian, and they do not perceive the reason. They are suffering because even the family ties are often broken without reason, you know?
When you see this war happening in Russia, and actually maybe other conflicts in the world, and maybe even we can see that democracy are actually being less and less influential in the world, or just like there are less and less democracies in the world, I believe, I'm not sure. Do you get discouraged about the project of cosmopolitan democracy?
Very discouraged. I mean, if you look at the latest report of the International Democracy and Electoral Assistance Organization in Stockholm, you really see that the quality of democracy is deteriorating. And it is deteriorating because in international conflicts, you don't have the resources to develop democracy. And we are seeing that in many democratic countries, the quality of democracy is deteriorating very much. And that's very, very bad. I repeat, we have lost a unique historical location at the beginning of the 90s. We should have managed to expand the cooperation. And unfortunately, we got more and more under the control of a few very arrogant and authoritarian leaders, often supported by wealthy people. And that, I think, is another condition, you know? The idea of democracy is that all citizens count equal, regardless if they're rich, they're poor, or whatever it is. Now, you really see that not only in Russia, where you really see that oligarchs are controlling the country, oligarchs exploiting natural resources, but also in other democratic countries, such as the United States, such as Argentina. Money can really decide the political process. And that, of course, is not democracy.
Yeah.
Because we are moving. I mean, the idea of democracy is that you count people, you don't count money. But if at a certain point within the electoral campaigns, rich people can really influence or can even buy votes, in that case, you see, it's democracy is in serious danger.
And so you see this as a problem, the role of money inside the democracy when they are already democracies, or also with countries that are not democratic yet?
In both. I think that the problem, I mean, we always had unequal access to the political process, even in very consolidated democracy. I mean, back in the 1960s, 1950s, the owners of a newspaper had more power compared to those which didn't have access to information means. Likewise, when private television started to be at the fore, we have seen how they could shape the political process. In Italy, for example, it's well known that Silvio Berlusconi was influential for so long for many reasons, but also because he controlled half of the TV networks, mm-hmm. You know. And now the situation is even more important because we know with social networks, social networks enter into our life and might shape the way in which we think and which we act much more than newspapers or televisions.
Mm.
And if people know how to use the social networks, of course they have a strong political impact,
mm-hmm.
and that I think should be taken into account. So we are very much in a situation in which democracy has been eroded.
So let me try to unify a bit everything we are saying. So first, there is this idea of cosmopolitan democracy, this dream, this ideal, let's say, and trying to have democracy everywhere at all levels.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the problem that in 1990, when there was the possibility, we actually made mistakes, and this created more opposition instead of more cooperation. And since, I mean, now you're saying also that it's very hard to change this current situation, and you're getting a bit discouraged at this situation, which is actually worsening in respect to cosmopolitan democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be you mentioned at least three ways where we could actually make a change, which is, first one, you say that people maybe should realize what has been happening and realize that there is no reason to be a war between Russia and Ukraine. And so if people could get aware of that, that would make me change something. Secondly, the influence of economy, of wealth in the political process of both democratic and non-democracy. And third, another kind of influence with social media, with information. Is it a good summary?
I think it's a good summary. I mean, those are some of the problems we are facing, you know. But I mean, my hope is that, you know, where is the solution?
Mm.
The solution is in the fact that we ask citizens to participate more in the political sphere. And that's difficult, because if we can go back to your compatriot Benjamin Constant wrote this famous paper about the freedom of ancients and the freedom of the moderns, in which he said for ancients the freedom was to participate, for the modern the freedom is to delegate and be free in the private sphere. I think that's a major problem, and the major problem that we need to go back to the freedom of the ancients, namely to participate more.
Mm-hmm.
And to participate more is time consuming. People are not willing to do that. The majority of young people are less willing to participate. For example, they are less likely to go to elections because they are much, much happier to exercise the freedom within the private sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel that political participation within social media is enough, for example. And that, I think, is a serious problem. So, but I think that, on the contrary, if we will manage to squeeze more citizen participation, that can be a counterbalance at all levels, within nations, at the global level, to the abuses of power that we are experiencing today.
Okay, so you're saying there are abuses of power, for instance, with people who control too much wealth and people who control too much the information. And the way to counterbalance it is to have more citizens getting engaged in the democratic system. And it's indeed then very discouraging because, I mean, also the statistics show that new generations are even less approving of democracy than the previous generation.
Well, yes, I've seen this data and I am not sure how to interpret them. One of the reasons that perhaps in some countries, younger generations have not experienced the dictatorships, such as in Italy, in Germany, and therefore they don't really know what a dictatorship can be, you know. But certainly it's a very, very dangerous outcome. And we know that young people are voting less than old people, for example. Mm. So they don't bother to go to vote because they are discouraged. And we need to get more forms of participation, which are also associated to the delivery, because young people often are, for example, very keen to participate in social movements. Think about the environment, think about even human rights. And therefore, they are less likely to vote, but more likely to take direct action. Mm-hmm. And that's good news.
Okay, yeah. Because to go in your sense, from what you were saying at the very beginning, it's true. I mean, in the study that I've seen about younger generation, which are less approving of democracy, they were saying that when there was a populist leader elected, such as Donald Trump in the US, or at the time it was Bolsonaro in Brazil, mm-hmm. People were actually a lot more supportive of democracy afterwards. Mm. But I also don't know how to interpret it, if it's because they were satisfied with these new powerful leaders and this is what made them like more their current regime, or if it's because they thought on the opposite, oh, we had this, so actually we absolutely need more democracy, you know? I don't know in which sense to interpret that.
Well, I mean, I think both interpretation are legitimate. We need to, and possibly both of them are there. Mm. So I think that indeed, every time there is an authoritarian change, people get scared. But again, the elections in the United States are worrying because the American public knew very well who Donald Trump is and what Donald Trump has done as former president of the United States. Mm, mm, mm. And therefore this is a sign that unfortunately we cannot unconditionally rely on the wiseness of the population. Mm. And that says, you know, it's also it tells us that more effort is needed in order to involve people in the decision-making process.
Yeah, it's very difficult and paradoxical because, I mean, on the one hand, we want to have people participate even more, and then maybe, I mean, you are disappointed with the result, with what they choose in the democracy.
Yes, I agree. But still, I mean, we shouldn't forget that a large number of the voters do not go to vote.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's a problem within the United States, it's a problem in a country with a higher turnout, such as the United Kingdom. It starts to be a problem also in countries such as Italy or such as Spain. Both countries experienced the dictatorships, and we had, perhaps also as a consequence, very high electoral turnout. Mm. And that should be taken into account. You know? So, but again, to repeat, there is a basic problem that people are less inclined to participate in the political process. They are discouraged about that.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is a bit the situation where people don't have the taste anymore for democracy. And mm-hmm. I mean, this is one theory I mentioned in one previous episode for the people who actually saw the previous ones. I was thinking that maybe, I mean, it's what you said, maybe younger people, including me, we have never experienced dictatorship, so we don't know really what it's like. And maybe we are just bored of democracy, which is very sad because it has huge consequences. But just because we are bored, maybe we try for something else, for something different.
Yeah, yeah. That's the problem. That's the problem. But again, I repeat, we see that there is a willingness to participate.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, also the political process should sometimes be able to include and ask citizens to participate in something which is visible. And again, democracy is not only about rights, it is also about duties. And if we speak about duties, it means that more people need to participate in the political process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it should not be only considered as a right, also like as a duty, something that people feel they have to do.
Obligations. Yeah. That I think are very important.
I think the point you make about the fact that many people would actually be very happy to get, to get more involved actively. There are many people, you're right. I mean, in France, it's quite very visible how people want to strike and, you know, the Gilets jaunes or this kind of phenomena where people actually really go in the street and really have are politically committed, you know. So it's very also paradoxical, and maybe it could be a key, what we've just said before, that maybe people are bored with democracy, with the political regime, but at the same time they have so much political energy and the willingness to get committed politically. So maybe the problem, I'm trying something, maybe the problem is that we haven't found yet a way to make democracy or the political life more interesting and stimulating in the way that satisfies the people, you know, that stimulates them and really makes them more feel fulfilled.
Yes, and that's something. I mean, I think that, for example, if people will be asked to participate more, they will understand also better what the relationship between the delivery of public goods and involvement, you mm-hmm. know? And there is a lot of very limited information. I mean, I can provide plenty of examples. For example, in the majority of public transport is provided by the government, you know, local government. Citizens do not really know what are the costs associated to it. They don't have an idea of how much is paid by the ticket and how much is paid by general taxation. If they will know something more about the costs, perhaps they will also, you know, understand better the choices, and by the way, this will be a very strong incentive to increase efficiency in the public sector and also to reduce corruption.
To go in your sense, I mean, I have a personal anecdote about that. I went I had to buy a medicine. I think it was given for free or like very minimal amount of €5. Mm-hmm. And I've learned later that what I had bought was actually worth €100. And I didn't even feel it, you know, like, I mean, it had been 1 year I was taking this medicine without actually understanding it. And I was just paying €100 per month, but actually, no, I was paying €0 and not realizing how much it's worth.
Yes, so. That again is something that the government should inform about that.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be difficult to say, you know, according to our general estimate, you go to the bus, you pay €1.50 ticket,
yeah.
But the ride costs €6.
Yeah.
And you pay, because, I mean, of course, it's always the citizens who that
pay. Ultimately, yeah.
Ultimately pay, but the citizen pays the other €4.50 through general taxation or yeah. through local taxes or whatever.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is something which will help citizens to understand better. We are very much in a situation in which we do not have an idea, and that creates often some non-realistic expectations of what can be done in terms of the delivery of public services, in terms of pensions, in terms of all these sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you would say it's, I mean, if I generalize it a bit, it's about bringing more responsibility to people, making them more
yes.
autonomous and responsible, and face the consequences of what they're living with. And I can also see a link with what we said before about the fact that we are bored with democracy. Like, we have this, for instance, welfare state, mm-hmm. which is amazing and it's very comfortable in Europe. And we don't realize how much effort is that and how much people had to fight for this. And maybe this is if we were more responsible and autonomous, maybe we would realize better
yes.
how important.
Yes, indeed. For example, in Italy, we have got a GP, a general doctor, you know, which
yeah.
is free. And that's one great achievement of the Italian welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why we have got a very high life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
And people get used to have it.
Mm-hmm.
But do we really know how much the government pays for that and which part of our general taxation goes to that?
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the United Kingdom, they have started to release some documents in which every time you pay the income tax, they give you a very aggregate breakdown of the expenditures of the government.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a piece of paper. But that, I think, are the sort of things which will help to get more participation of the citizens.
Yeah. Another topic, I mean, in this, because, I mean, you're a professor, you've been working at universities. It's heavily funded. I mean, I remember seeing that one student was costing so much money for the state, at least in some countries, depend on the country, of course, but for France, like, it's a huge amount that I was not suspecting at all.
That's a good point. Perhaps if you would have known earlier, you would have been more demanding towards your professors. And even towards the infrastructure, you know? Yes, of course. If it costs so much, you expect that professors respond to students' emails.
Yeah.
Or you expect that they go in class on time.
Yeah.
They don't speak on the mobile when they are lecturing.
Yeah.
And they're updating to the field, you know?
Mm-hmm,
those
mm-hmm.
sort of things.
Okay, so this is a way, I mean, here we're speaking mostly for democratic countries, right? And for non-democratic countries, do you think that there should be, do you wish that non-democratic countries become democratic? I think yes, because you would like it at the international level.
Of course. But that's, I mean, again, to go back to the cosmopolitan democracy model, that's, I think, is very important to understand. I think that all countries can improve the democratic process. Of course, it's not the same thing if you're in Sweden or if you are in China.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that the Swedish model is the best and that should fit all the countries of the world, you know? And I think that all countries will benefit to develop some ways of democracy. But this should be done internally.
Mm-hmm.
Through their forces.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not for me or for anybody else to tell to the Chinese what they should do,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or to the Russians.
Yeah.
We can also, the only thing we can do is to provide good examples. And if we do, perhaps it will be easier to convince the Chinese or the Russians that they have an advantage to develop democracy.
Which makes the decrease of support, the internal decrease of support in democracy, even more important, because we have less of a model for the others.
But even if this is the case, when we go to non-democratic countries, we really see the difference, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is important in terms of welfare, in terms of wages. I mean, there is a lot to gain with democracy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I call the democratic dividend,
mm-hmm.
you know? And the democratic dividend is important because in democracies, salaries are higher, human rights are more respected, so there are a lot of advantages.
Mm-hmm. And you say that it needs to come spontaneously from them and not from external pressure. I spent 1 year in China, and there I could not really speak about it or whatever, but speaking with many Chinese people, I don't know what is also 100% honest or not, but I think that many of them are actually very happy with their regime and don't think that it should be moved, that they think mostly what I was hearing is that, okay, democracy maybe is good, but not for such a big country. When it's such a big country, we need to have dictatorship.
Well, China is a unique case by many aspects. For example, it's very I'm not aware of any historical case in which a country has grown 10% a year, the GDP has grown 10% a year for two decades.
Mm-hmm.
In a country which had large parts of poverty, you know,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I understand very well that why the Chinese government has strong support,
mm-hmm.
because it's a government which has managed to deliver an enormous amount of benefits to its population.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I do not necessarily, and it's a government which, when they decide to do something, they do it. If they decide to create an underground in a city of 15 million people in 10 years, at the end of the 10th year, the underground is there.
Mm-hmm.
And this cannot be said of many of the countries of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I think that China will also benefit from democracy. For example, at the moment, China, the average paid holiday per year are 5 days.
Mm.
In Italy, there are 25 days.
Mm.
The Chinese people understand the difference,
you
know? And they also understand that sometimes some of their rights can be destroyed.
Mm-mm-mm-mm.
And therefore, you know, it's important to show to the Chinese that they can do something better. And on the other hand, I think that also we can learn something from the Chinese. For example, in terms of delivering what is decided, you know. Let me also say that China is a peculiar country because it has one party system, of course, but often the decision-making process is very complex at the local level, within the party, within the community, and therefore they consult each other.
Mm-hmm.
And once they consult each other, they study, and then they decide. And then the situation is to apply the decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that there are some studies about the political process in China, especially 15 years ago, in which we shown that there was a consultation process.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'm drifting us a bit further, too far from our original purpose, but there is also, I think in this case, an interesting comparison is with India, because it's the same population, but it's democratic.
Again, India is not a very interesting case. It's a democratic country, but still there is a lot of poverty.
Yeah.
And totally different system of infrastructures.
Mm-hmm.
In China, you really see that they build airports, trains, schools, roads.
Mm-hmm.
And in China, it's more likely that, you know, people are searching for their own personal advantages.
Yeah. So that brings us also back to what you were saying at the beginning. From what you say, that the progress you made and how much you are able to deliver, you say, public goods for the people, that counts a lot for the people supporting democracy. So there is a huge work at least also there. Definitely.
Okay. If you want to defend the ideal of democracy, the democracy needs to work not well, in an excellent form, because they should be much better than alternative forms of government. We cannot be idealistic and to think that we just support democracy because it provides human rights.
Mm.
That is important, but it's not the only condition.
Okay. I have one last question, and then I will ask you last word if you want. My last question is, we've spoken a lot at the societal level, at the community level, let's say, and do you think that there's anything that one person can do at the individual level for a cosmopolitan democracy?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, there are a lot of things that can be done. The first thing is to participate to citizens' networks in specific domains, which might be human rights campaigns, ecological campaigns, or any form of social activism, trying to link with others.
Mm-hmm. So getting people connected and committed in the politics, as we were discussing before.
And that's, of course, you know, with the current information and communication technologies, it's much easier than it used to be in my own time.
Mm.
It's very easy to create a network, which I would say should also be associated to deliver something,
mm-hmm.
you know, a campaign specific on some ecological human rights goals and so on, that you target decision makers as well as decision making, and you try to involve more players into the decision-making process. Okay. And that often is very effective.
Why do you add the precision that it should be specific to one goal and deliver one kind?
Well, I mean, if we are speaking about focus groups, sometimes they start in that way, but mm-hmm. sometimes they can also participate in more campaigns, you know? Mm-hmm. And that if, for example, if you start with one goal, it's more likely that you will manage to bridge and to include citizens which belong to different states. Mm-hmm. And therefore, for example, if you think, for example, about human rights mm-hmm. and women rights, you can perhaps involve also people in Arab countries in which these sort of things are forbidden. Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. I had not realized, but so you have this global scope in mind when you were saying getting committed. Why not also doing it as a group with different countries, like some
indeed,
international?
Indeed, I repeat, democracy, if they want, to be a good model and enlarge the geographic scope, they cannot do it with war. They should do it through persuasion. Mm. They should do it by convincing people of all the countries that it is in the interest to become undemocratic.
Well, many thanks for this conversation.
And thank you very much.
If you want to have a last word or a summary or one thing.
I think we have covered it.
We covered it. Okay. Thank you very
thank
much.
You very
and
much.
See you for the next episode. Ciao.
Thank you.
Thank you for having listened to this episode. This is the kind of episode which will, without any doubt, trigger a lot of comments. So I'm looking forward to have this conversation on the social media. And the next episode will be published on the 1st of February.